From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast. Welcome to the August 2018 episode of the Bletchley Park podcast, Countdown to D-Day. In August 1943, at the Quebec Conference, the Allies began the initial discussions for what would ultimately become Operation Overlord, the invasion of France in 1944. So it seems fitting that 75 years later, Bletchley Park have released the plans for what will be an exciting new exhibition, opening in spring 2019. D-Day, Interception, Intelligence, Invasion, will tell the story of the vital role that GC and CS played in informing the D-Day invasion. It will introduce the people involved and show how different kinds of intelligence were used by the Allies to enable the invasion of Normandy on the 6th of June 1944 with precise detail. In this episode, we'll take you behind the hoardings of the teleprinter building. Our research historian, Dr. David Kenyon, tells us how the restoration has revealed a wealth of new insights into the buildings. But first, exhibitions manager Erica Monroe explains why this story is so important.
Erica, can you tell us why this new exhibition is going to be so important to how we tell the full story of Bletchley Park?
Well, whilst elsewhere on the site, we've been able to talk in quite a lot of detail about the code-breaking work that went on here and the people that did that work, we haven't really had the chance to look at the bigger effect of what that had on the war, the role that work had in wartime. But the exhibition that we're looking at now, the D-Day exhibition, will really give us the opportunity to look at the impact of Bletchley Park's work on the wider war.
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? We tend to, I suppose we could be found a little guilty maybe of the fact that we concentrate on the capturing of the radio signals and then the decryption of that and how important that was. In some of the more recent exhibitions, though, we have looked at the bigger picture, haven't we?
We have. In Hut 11A, for example, that opened in March of this year, we do look a little at the impact and the legacy of the bomb machines. But it's certainly an area that we haven't really had a chance to experiment with or look into in the wider site and the wider Bletchley Park narrative. So this exhibition about D-Day really gives us that opportunity to look at the impact of the code-breaking work and also the intelligence work. Bletchley Park wasn't all about decryption and decoding, whilst that was obviously a huge and very well-known part of the story. It was more than just deciphering intercepted messages on D-Day itself. Bletchley Park had had a role for months, if not years, beforehand, taking the information from those decrypted messages and analysing the information and creating intelligence, which was sent back out to the leadership of the armed forces, the Allies, and that could then inform the Normandy campaign.
Well, David's spoken in the It Happened Here episodes about the committee that was set up here that was meeting weekly from late 1942, I think, doing exactly what you've just been talking about, collating all this information a good 18 months, 2 years before.
Absolutely. Bletchley Park's role wasn't just to help the Allies know what the enemy was doing. It was to help them understand what the enemy was thinking.
Now, this exhibition isn't going to open until spring 2019 in readiness for the 75th anniversary of D-Day. And we don't want to give away too much about what people are going to see, do we? But can you just give us a flavour of, you know, maybe, has this been really interesting to you to try and create this new way of telling the story?
It has been. The research for the exhibition has brought up a lot of new information. Dr. David Kenyon, our historian, who you know well through the podcast, has done a lot of original research for it. And that's been fascinating, finding out new facts, finding out just a new perspective on how Bletchley Park's importance during the war was key to what was decided, not just on D-Day, but in the preparations for D-Day. I think the exhibition is going to give visitors a bit of background to that bigger picture in a really concentrated way that means that it puts into context a little bit what they'll be finding out elsewhere around the site. The exhibition is going to be in Teleprinter Building, which has been recently restored. The restoration and the exhibition itself have been made possible by the partnership and sponsorship of BT. And while I can't say too much about the exhibition's content at the moment, as you say, we have a fair way to go before it opens. What I can say is we're anticipating it's going to be quite a highlight of the visitor experience here at Bletchley Park.
Yes, it's not that we haven't planned it. It's the fact that we're very good at keeping secrets here at Bletchley Park, and we like to keep a few secrets now and then, don't we?
It's been going on for a number of years here at Bletchley, and I don't see why that should change.
Here we are, David, outside what, for the whole time that I've been coming to Bletchley Park, we've always called the Teleprinter Hall. But that's not strictly true now, is it?
We have found through archival research that the hall part doesn't actually represent what the building looked like in the Second World War. It was built as the Teleprinter Building and had a very different character when it was first established.
And I think this might go some way to explaining some of the problems with some of our veterans' memories, because we know of certain veterans that were definitely in here during the war. And they look at this building, but it doesn't bring any memories back. And I think you can answer that now, can't you?
I can, because this whole area was massively remodeled when the site was taken over by a teacher training college in the early 1950s. And we have accounts from when they modified the buildings that describe what its former character was and what bits and pieces they changed to convert it to new use at that point.
Well, let's go in there and you can show me some of these, because it is massive changes that took place, isn't it?
Oh, very much so, yes.
So we're walking up this alleyway now. First off, how were these originally constructed? Because up till now, we thought of the buildings at Bletchley Park coming into two different varieties, didn't we? The huts that were thrown up early in the war, and then the blocks, the concrete blocks.
Exactly. But what we found looking at this building is that there's actually a third phase of construction at Bletchley, which we're provisionally calling machine buildings, because we've spoken previously about the work on Hut 11 and Hut 11A for the exhibition we opened earlier this year. And 11A, we knew, was built to a pattern that was replicated for other bomb outstations at Wavendon and at Gayhurst. But we didn't realise that that architectural style, if you like, had been replicated here on site. And actually, it turns out that this massive echoing teleprinter hall that we have now, when it was a teleprinter building originally, it was actually very similar to Hut 11A and to Hut 11, and was completely different to what it is now. Looking at the structure now, you can see all the various changes that have been made. If you know what it looked like originally, then suddenly all sorts of little bits of the building that you thought were a bit random before start to fall into place and start to tell the story in bricks and mortar as well as in paper.
This is the thing about Bletchley, isn't it? After all these years of the museum being open, it's still revealing its secrets, isn't it? We've only just discovered this.
Very much so. And one of the features of this building was, although it was substantially altered, a lot of bits of the original building were still there. They'd just been covered up by the floor surfacing, for example, the stage that was built in there, other bits and pieces. So the building work gave me, especially with my background as a buildings archaeologist, a wonderful opportunity to poke around in the rubble and kind of identify these previously hidden surviving bits of the structure. And when you compare those with the plans that we have from the wartime, you know, they match exactly. The story is completely there.
Our listeners will know you as our research historian, but your background is archaeology, isn't it?
Well, I was an archaeologist for about 20 years before I came to Bletchley, and analysing historic buildings is very much part of every archaeologist's day job these days. So I've worked on World War II buildings all around the country before I came here. So it's a great opportunity for me to sort of get my hands dirty a little bit and start
reviving
some old skills.
That every time there's a hole dug anywhere at Bletchley Park, you've got your head poking in it.
Pretty much, yes. Yeah. Yes, well, I can't walk past a hole.
Let's walk in, and we won't spend too long in the hall because the delay in there is about 7 seconds at the moment. But just talk me through the different changes to this building then.
Well, the first thing that you'll notice as we come in is we're going to go down a ramp. This ramp was put in 1952 because this end of the building originally was higher. The whole building falls down a gentle slope. So the wartime building had one end that was about 10 inches higher than the other end. And during the 1950s, they moved the step, if you like, between the low bit and the high bit, about 20 feet west. And so whereas this door would have previously gone into the high end, it now goes into the low end. So we'll walk down a ramp.
Yeah. Into the echoing cavernous teleprinter hall, as we called it. But our veterans wouldn't have known this, would they?
Not at all. I mean, we're now in a building that is about 10 metres wide, 20 metres long, 6 or 7 metres high, with an enormous curved roof There's windows at ceiling level all the way down one side, and you could play five-a-side football in here. It's basketball. It's enormous.
It's like a gymnasium, isn't it?
It sounds like a gym.
Yeah.
During the war, this would have been completely different. During that period, the roof was much, much lower. It was only 10 feet high, which is a little over half what it is now. As built, it had no windows at all. It was a deliberately hardened, bomb-proof structure that they could put teleprinter machines in, and those machines would be safe if the site was attacked. So in here, whereas now it feels light and airy and echoey, then it would have been like going into Hut 11. It would have had that low ceiling, that sort of cramped, gloomy, sort of sweaty, smelly vibe that those buildings have, completely different to what's in here.
The reason for that is very practical, isn't it? Because you can always replace the people, but the machines are a lot more difficult to replace, aren't they?
Well, it's not quite as callous as that. The principle is that equipment gets bomb-proof buildings and people are left in timber huts. But that's because in the event of an air raid, you can evacuate the people. They can all walk out on their own legs and go into an air raid shelter. The machines can't do that. So the hardened part of it was built at the same time as what's known as Hut 14, which was by the standards of Bletchley, more civilised space, which was a timber-built building with windows and everything else. These two buildings were built together starting in summer of 1941, and they opened in January of 1942. Although Frank Birch mentions in his history that the same problem applied throughout Bletchley Park's history, they were almost obsolete before they were occupied because the site had moved on so much in that 6 months that they were already planning what becomes the teleprinter extension, which is through that wall there. Which we call Block E, or part of Block E. It's between us and Block E proper. And before they'd finished that, they started as a single-storey building. They had to build an upstairs to it, put a whole second floor on it. So they're running to catch up with these structures all the time. The other thing that really confirms the link between this building and Huts 11 and 11A and the bomb buildings is when we took the parquet up in here, we found the original Second World War floor.
Oh, right.
And it's quite distinctive. There's a sort of solid concrete footing, and then there's a screed, to the technical term, a thin layer of concrete on top. But that had grooves in it about 5 centimetres wide. And if you go into those other buildings, you'll see exactly the same grooves with timber battens laid in them. And it seems here that the battens themselves have been taken out at some point, probably in the 50s. But the floor was there.
Mm.
We're not quite sure why they built it that way. Probably it's as simple as if you've got a concrete floor, if you tack some battens to it, then when you put your screed down, you can just use a plank to kind of level it off.
Yeah.
And then you don't need to take the battens back out again, you just leave them there.
Yeah.
Also, they would have provided a certain amount of, you know, shock absorption. Mm. You know, they would have prevented the floor cracking potentially. But we didn't realise that kind of flooring was in here. And as soon as I saw it, I thought, this is the same as next door. There is a definite architectural plan to which all of these buildings are constructed.
Because after this, they then start moving on to what we would call the spider blocks. So Block D and Block C, where the visitor centre is. Did that take over from this? Or was it the fact that they already had enough machine buildings here?
I think that they had enough machine buildings. Those buildings are built to a standard government design. And you see those buildings elsewhere. I've worked on some in Malvern, for example, at the radar establishment. And there are others in Cheltenham. They were built all around the country.
They're used for hospitals as well.
Yes, they're a standard design. But what's striking about Block D in particular over the back there is both, this is where it gets complicated, Hut 3 and Hut 8 both had teleprinters as part of their own setup.
Right.
When they were in the timber huts. When those two departments moved to Block D, they still needed space for their teleprinters. So what they did was they built teleprinter rooms on the spurs of Block D that were occupied by Hut 3 and Hut 8. And again there, they built windowless steel-reinforced bits. So the only bits of that Block D that are the non-standard bits, if you like, are the bits that have machinery in them, which are still built to a different design.
Now, the listeners will be able to hear. We've come through to what, for years now, has just been the foyer for this part of the building. But this also is completely different, isn't it? This very 50s modernisation.
This part of the building is in some ways more like its World War II sort of original design, but in other ways very different. Here we still have the original height ceiling, so I can, because I'm tall, I can reach up and touch it. The roof is only 10 feet tall here. And the sound in here is quite dead as well, because there are modern ceiling tiles in here, but actually the original building had acoustic tiling on it.
These are the same tiles that we found in Block C, aren't they?
In Block C, yes. We know that during the war, they put up acoustic tiling in here, similar to that we've got in Block C, for the same reason that there were machines clattering away in here and they were trying to kind of damp the noise down a bit. Because if you imagine it was a windowless concrete box, it would have been absolutely deafening. But the other striking thing about this part of the building is the lobby entrance now is essentially a glass wall along the south part of this part of the building. There wasn't a wall there in World War II because extending in that direction was the wooden part of the building for the staff. This was Hut 14, as it was called. And it ran from where we're standing now out through those lobby doors and about 20 metres in that direction. That was wood. But what's curious about that is, checking aerial photographs from the time, it doesn't have the pitched roof that all the other huts on the site have. It had a flat roof that was the same height as the roof of the concrete bit. So it's clearly kind of a continuous design style, but it's just that bit's built of wood and this bit's built of brick.
That's strange, isn't it?
Yeah.
It does explain why our veterans' memories seem to not be right, because the buildings aren't right. That's what it is, isn't it? I mean, that's the thing. So much changed. This was used by so many different organisations after World War II, wasn't it?
It was. And this is what makes not just Bletchley, but buildings archaeology interesting, because once structures get put up, they evolve. People change them, people occupy them for different purposes.
They have a life of their own.
They have a life of their own. And trying to unpick that story and take them back to what they were like originally is, you know, for me at least, is really exciting. I mean, one of the really giveaway bits of this building, funnily enough, is if we come to the extreme eastern end, we're just on a little side bit of the lobby here now. And on our left here, heading east, is the end wall of Block A, which is the original naval section. And that goes for a huge distance, Blocks A and B in that direction. Where we were standing during the war was a little narrow alleyway that ran between the end of the teleprinter building and the beginning of Block A.
Because we can see
that's a big fat wall here. Yeah,
and that's an end wall, isn't it?
That's the end wall that's been cut through. And Hut 15, which used to be around the back there, a number of the codebreakers talk about using this as a cut-through, because otherwise there was a big long row of buildings along the side of the lake here, and the only way through was basically this gap. But now we're indoors, and there's a wall blocking off the gap at either end. And if you look at the southern end of it, there's a perfectly circular window.
Very 1950s, isn't it?
Completely 1950s, and absolutely not something that would have been put in World War II.
No.
So over here, we're in 1941. If I take a step this way, I'm now in 1952.
So. And it's crazy, isn't it? There is so much. As we were walking around, you were showing me where the brickwork changes, and that was a different building phase.
Exactly. And in the southern spur of the building, the so-called VF wing, that again was windowless, but now it has a whole raft of windows and doors that were put in at different periods of its history. And to incorporate the exhibition, we've actually remodeled some of those windows and doors ourselves now in 2018.
Yeah.
And in another 50 years, that'll just be another phase of the story of the building, hopefully, as it continues its life on into the future.
And who was in here during the war? I mean, we call it the teleprinter building, but was it just teleprinter operators, or were there other sections in here as well?
There were a variety of different bits and pieces in here. The main teleprinter bit that we're stood in now, the lobby and then the hall, had about 60 teleprinter machines in it. And they were communicating with both inward and outward traffic to War Office, Admiralty, other government departments, and latterly to the Y stations that are intercepting traffic that's being teleprinted down. However, then the wooden bit, Hut 14 down there, had kind of the people who were administrating the teleprinters, but also had what was called the cipher room. And they had Typex machines in there because a lot of this teleprinted traffic was encrypted as well. So,
and the Typex was our...
Typex was the British equivalent of the Enigma machine, basically. Yeah. It was an encryption machine. So they had the cipher room in there as well for encrypting and decrypting incoming and outgoing messages, because it's not just a matter of turning the German messages into plain English. If you then want to send them to someone else, you've got to re-encode them using our own ciphers. So that's what's going on in there. However, as I was saying, the site's growing so quickly and things are changing so fast that after about 6 months, they build another hut. They build Hut 14A, which was slightly to the west of Hut 14. They move the cipher office into there, and then they reorganize everybody. But even then, the cipher office in there, when they build Block E over to the north of us there, cipher office moves again, and that Hut 14A becomes spare, which is useful because the VF wing, as it's called, the southern spur of the building, had GPO staff in there operating what in those days was really cutting-edge communications technology, which was this voice frequency teleprint operation. And what this does is, normally a teleprinter, you have a single wire and you have basically an on-off current that allows you to create, you know, a beep, which you then use for Morse or you use for typically for Bow dot teleprinter code. They figured out in the 1930s that an ordinary telephone line actually has a huge frequency range that it can cover, obviously to capture all the different tones in the human voice. Mm-hmm. What you can do is you can break that range of frequencies down into as many as 48 separate little channels.
Yep.
And you can send a separate teleprinter message down each channel all simultaneously. And if you do it right, you can also include a little bit of bandwidth that still allows you to talk on the telephone. So it's an extraordinarily efficient way of communicating information. But as I say, it was brand new technology at that point. So they had a permanent team of GPO engineers keeping all that kit going and making sure that it functioned properly. And it's fundamental because we've always talk about just the sheer volume of traffic coming in and out at any one time. It's not a case of, you know, you've got one phone or one teleprinter. There's 60 machines in here all clattering away, and all of those need to be connected somehow to the outside world.
Well, the main telephone trunk line for Britain, north and south, was running down the A5, wasn't it, which is quite close to here. Which
it was. It's less than a mile away. And actually, if we go sort of northwest from here, you go across what used to be the Lyons Park to the railway line. And they dug a cable trench in 1938 and connected the whole lot up. Also in Leighton Buzzard, you have RAF Stanbridge, which was a major hub for the nationwide military telephone teleprinter network. So Bletchley is actually really well placed to communicate with the rest of the world from that point of view. And that communication, beginning of 1942, happened from this building. Mm. I mean, they carry on in here, but of course they build Block E as well because the demand becomes even greater. The weird thing is that 1945, all of that technology disappears and you're left with basically an empty space. And the post office was still here and the GPA used what we now think of as the teleprinter hall as a cinema. But it was a particularly poor cinema because it had a roof only 10 feet high and it had steel supports running all the way down the middle of the room. But possibly inspired by that, when the teacher training college took over and they got a bit of budget in the 1950s, they were like, well, let's make this a proper cinema. Let's put a stage in. Let's raise the roof. Let's take the central stanchions away and all of that. And we were lucky because there's a drawing from the education college showing a pond where the voice frequency extension is.
Oh.
So we nearly lost that whole wing of the building to a fish pond. But it would seem fortunately for us that they ran out of budget before they knocked it down. So we still have that bit of the building that might otherwise just have been demolished. The hut parts, hut 14 and 14A, have been demolished since the 40s. But we might have lost that bit of the building as well.
Like so much of the story of Bletchley Park, very close to being destroyed so many times.
Exactly. And just on the stanchions to hold the ceiling up, I read in the account that the sight lines were broken up by these steel girders coming up from the floor. And I thought, oh, I wonder if there's any evidence of that. So when the floor was exposed, I came back in. And sure enough, there weren't the steels, but there were little patches of repaired concrete on the floor running in a line of dots down the centre of the building.
So it's clearly
where they'd been broken out when they put the new ceiling on. And what's particularly satisfying for me about this whole project is I spend a lot of my time making discoveries in the archives, which are tremendously exciting. Yeah. They tell the story of Bletchley Park and you find out about people or events. Researching a building like this has an extra dimension to it because when I find a written account of what the building might have been like, I can literally walk from my office up here and start trying to find traces that match that written account. And the example of the holes in the floor for the support columns is exactly that. You know, what's on the piece of paper is there in real life to be found.
And I suppose it goes back to your first love, doesn't it, of archaeology?
It very much so, yeah. I like it when things fit together. You know, one piece of evidence is nice. Two matching pieces of evidence is great. And especially if they come from different places. Yeah. And this can happen with a document and something in a veteran testimony or wherever. You know, when things cross-attach like that and the story becomes complete from different directions.
You start making those links and those connections. Yeah. And we can tell the story better, can't we?
Absolutely.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.